This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
Hello everyone and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
Missing in action, why the world can't expect Trump's America to lead the cavalry against COVID. Margaret Sullivan of the Washington Post and Fintan O'Toole of the Irish Times on leadership and accountability. Then,
it'd be awkward if something happened to us.
No one would have to know.
Everybody's talking about normal people. And I speak to the stars of the hit new series, Daisy Edgar-Jones and Paul Mescal, about this beautiful story of love, intimacy, and coming of age. Plus,
if New York had moved about 10 days faster to shut things down, we would have seen 50 to 80% fewer fatalities in New York.
Journalist and author Charles Duhigg compares how different states are fighting this virus.
Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour, working from home in London. For months now, the world has been connected and consumed by one struggle, the health and economic devastation waged by the coronavirus. And these images beamed around the globe of overwhelmed hospital wards, unbearable scenes from care homes, lines of people rushing to go home as borders closed, or waiting at food banks, raised a horrified question. Sure, it's happening elsewhere, but how did this happen in America, the richest, most scientifically advanced nation in the whole world? How did a third of all confirmed cases globally, 1 million infections, come to be in the United States? And why can even a crisis of this magnitude apparently not stop President Trump from peddling tales made out of whole cloth, downright dangerous suggestions, and even ramping up his war with the press? This pandemic is sending shockwaves through the very idea of American exceptionalism, of that city on a hill, that global leader that other countries could look up to and call on in a crisis. Here to discuss are two guests who've been asking those very questions, Washington Post columnist and media expert Margaret Sullivan and Irish Times columnist Fintan O'Toole in Dublin, who says the world has loved, hated and even envied the United States. Now, for the first time, we pity it. Fintan O'Toole and Margaret Sullivan, welcome to the program. Fintan, let me start with you, because those are very strong words and a very strong sentiment. Of course, the world has had a complicated relationship for a long time with the United States. Why do you choose the word pity?
I think because it's what I feel, and it's what I get the impression that a lot of people feel. There's a genuine sympathy for what ordinary people in the United States are suffering and are going to continue to suffer. And a horror that they're suffering that largely because of the most appalling display of bad political authority that we've probably seen in the democratic West for a very, very long time. We're all used to looking to the United States, whether we love it or hate it, as a kind of touchstone. It's the, you know, the great power in the world. And to see, as you mentioned in your introduction, you know, a country which has so many advantages going into this crisis, the advantage of time and warning, the advantage of almost infinite financial resources, of a military complex which has astounding capacities, the greatest concentration of scientific and medical expertise in the world, fantastic public spirit. I mean, all of those advantages have been utterly undermined by this horrific spectacle that we've been watching of the way in which Donald Trump has undermined at every juncture the good advice that any responsible leader would be giving at this time. So all our governments are failing in some way, But I don't think you can point to any other government in the rich democratic world that has had such a malignant presence at its heart in this crisis.
Can I just ask you to pinpoint, apart from the controversial press briefings, which I'm going to get to with Margaret in a second, but in terms of actual action, what, for instance, do you see your own government in Ireland having done differently compared to what you're seeing in the United States?
Well, I mean, very simple stuff, obviously, which was actually listen to the World Health Organization, listen to expertise, look at what the experience had already been in China and Korea and Taiwan, and learn rapidly that there were things that would work, which were to do with putting social distancing in place and having being ready with the capacity to test and trace. We know that's the stuff that worked, and the Irish government and most other democratic governments pretty much followed that template. I mean, here in Ireland, you know, we cancelled St. Patrick's Day in early March, right? You know, it was a statement going out to the public. This is really, really serious. It's a matter of life and death. We're giving you a clear, simple message. This is what you must do. Please follow it. And you had all through that period, you had Trump, more or less suggesting that the whole thing could be a hoax, that it would all just disappear, that it really wasn't to be taken seriously. And even at the end of March, when he finally did seem to take it seriously and accept that this was a huge crisis, he then continued very shortly afterwards to actively undermine what states have been doing. I mean, these tweets about, you know, calling on people to liberate their states from governors who are, you know, putting in place restrictions to save people's lives. That's absolutely astonishing. And it is deadly. I mean, this mixed messaging from Trump, has undoubtedly cost many, many lives and will continue to do so, because a lot of people still look to Trump for authority and they take what he says seriously.
Clearly, we've been watching and reading from around the world this sort of, you know, staggered reaction to what's going on in the United States. I want to ask you, Margaret, because you're in the United States, you've just written one of your latest columns for The Washington Post has been, you know, essentially that Trump is playing the media as puppets. But first, before you get to that, I want to know what you make of what Fintan has said, that in as much as actual executive actions, it's what's coming from the Daily Podium that has caused this reaction from Fintan and many others around the world?
Well, I do think that's the case. And, you know, Fintan's recent column was so powerful and so eloquent. He's right. And that's why I have written that I don't think that taking these briefings, which can sometimes go to 90 minutes or 2 hours, and often include a lot of disinformation, lies, misleading kinds of things, that taking them live is a mistake because it pours all of this stuff into our public sphere, and it's damaging, which is not to say that we shouldn't be covering this as news, covering the news of it, but not taking it live has been my position.
Mm-hmm. Your position is many other things as well in your latest column. On the live issue, there's definitely a sort of two views on that. Obviously, there's the one you say, but there's also another one that's been written about by Olivia Newsy in the New York Magazine. And she wrote a very eloquent article. And remember, she asked a very pointed question of President Trump in the last briefing. But she said that, look, the world actually does need to see President Trump unfiltered, not through the lens or the pen or the editing capacity of sophisticated journalists who try their best to sometimes turn incoherence into a coherent message and thus also potentially falsify the product. So I wonder if there's another way you know, instead of just not taking them. And I wonder what you make, for instance, of Joe Lockhart, who, as you all, of course, know, was President Clinton's press secretary, who said that actually there should be specialist journalists asking real specialist questions, that nobody would be able to sort of, you know, sort of phase them on it. And there should be a sort of a all-for-one, one-for-all mentality, where journalists should follow up on behalf of each other and, you know, support each other when they come under attack from the podium.
Yes, I think that both Olivia and Joe Lockhart have made good points. And I'm not suggesting for a moment that we don't, you know, cover these briefings, that we don't take pieces of them and show them to the public. But when I hear President Trump talking about some bizarre supposed cure of perhaps injecting a disinfectant, and then later read that some people have gone ahead and done just that and hurt themselves, I think that there needs to be something between the president and the public. So perhaps just a tape delay or some immediate fact-checking and context that would put this into some kind of perspective would be wise. So, you know, and I also think that when President Trump is allowed to, you know, sort of spout off, insult people, say whatever it is he will, and the networks all fall in line and give him very precious airtime for hours at a time, I don't think that that is journalism that serves the citizenry very well.
Mm-hmm. So to that point, and I'm going to put this out there and then ask you and, in fact, Fintan to respond. Margaret, your own editor-in-chief, Marty Baron, said very early on in this administration, we are not at war, we are at work, we're going to work. And yet, every single day at the podium, there seems to be this almighty struggle between the executive and the free press. And I'm just going to play just a little sort of mashup of some sound bites just over the last week. Let's just play.
What do you say to Americans who are watching you right now who are scared?
I say that you're a terrible reporter. That's what I say. I think it's a very nasty question, and I think it's a very bad signal that you're putting out to the American people. It's such a basic, simple question, and you try and make it sound so bad. You ought to be ashamed of yourself.
No,
you know what? You ought to be ashamed.
Way.
You know you're a fake. You know that. Your whole network, the way you cover it, is fake. And most of you, and not all of you, but the people are wise to you. That's why you have a lower approval rating than you've ever had before, times probably three.
Well, you know what? Counterintuitively, I'm going to ask Fintan to react to this. What would happen, Fintan, if your prime minister, for instance, were to say that kind of thing to your press corps, your accredited press corps? What would your journalists do or say? You've obviously been watching this all-out war that's being waged every day between the press and the White House.
Well, I completely agree that what would happen here, certainly, is that journalists would back each other up. You know, journalists would collectively decide this is not about my newspaper or my TV channel or my radio station. This is about the function of the press in a democracy. And we have a duty, therefore, collectively to challenge this behavior, to get up and walk out, to boycott these press conferences if that's the only way to make the point. What Trump loves doing, of course, is sort of playing favorites, picking one off against the other, engaging in this kind of Punch and Judy show. And he loves it. He's reveling in all of this carnage and this division that he's causing. I do think, you know, the point that Mark's making is a really important one. It's an excruciating dilemma for journalists. How do you cover it when the vector in chief is the president? You can't not cover it. You can't ignore what he's doing. But I do think the free press has to take a stance, and it has to take a stance for the difference between lies and truth.
Mm-hmm. And it does its best. As you know, there's a huge sort of fact-checking machine going on all across the press. But Margaret, I just want to ask you, because as Fintan said, and as you've said, essentially the president is a master of this medium. He just is. And as you said, he's playing everybody like puppets. Not so long ago, Boris Johnson, who's the prime minister of this country, also very good at playing the press, quite a master of this medium. But the government tried to selectively invite people who they thought would be more friendly to them and disinvite those who may have had a different view, for instance, on Brexit or whatever, to a Downing Street event. And the entire press corps simply banded together and said, it's all of us or none of us. What do you think the American press in that room should do? I mean, I have to say, when I see my colleagues insulted like that on a daily basis, it really does break my heart and makes me wonder what I would do. So what are you saying? And you were the former ombudsman on all of this for the New York Times. So what do you think?
Well, a couple of observations. One is that one of the things that's going on in the United States is that there's something called Fox News, and it gives the Trump administration something that at times comes perilously close to state TV, which is very easily controllable, and it is used as a weapon against the rest of the press in a very effective way. And I don't think we see this, at least not to this extent, in the rest of the democratic world. So that is a huge factor. Of course, the press needs to back each other up, and I think to some extent they do. But Trump is very wily, and he has a huge base, and he plays to his base constantly. It's not as simple. It's not very simple. And the other point I would make is that I agree and continue to agree with my boss, Marty Baron, not just because he's my boss, but you talk about a war between the press and Trump. I don't think we are at war with him. I think we're trying to cover him, and he is at war with us.
Indeed. That's absolutely correct. Let me just quote something else you wrote, because Andy Lack, who's the head of NBC News, president of NBC News, published recently saying that the press is winning. And you said, because, you know, despite the odds, we tell Americans the truth every day, he said, you said in reaction, is this winning only in the sense that a verbally abused spouse is winning if she manages to get the kids off to school after another sleepless night? Well, I mean, you know, that's pretty vivid imagery. And let me now move it back to Fintan. The question here, Fintan, is that very few people, certainly not in President Trump's own party, are willing to say the emperor has no clothes. And also not amongst his global partners in the alliances and leadership. We're seeing right now that they are desperate. The world is desperate for traditional American leadership, as we've seen in previous crises, pandemics, financial devastation, and the rest. It's simply not happening this time. We haven't actually seen world leaders be as brave as perhaps they should be in this extraordinary face-off.
Yes, it's a great point to make, I think. Trump does not exist in a vacuum. So within the United States, of course, this is only possible because the ground has been prepared for it by the rise of the right wing within the Republican Party, the collapse of traditional conservatism, which of course would have, you know, emphasized safety, security, good authority, all of those kinds of old conservative values would have come into play. This crisis is showing us how deep the problem goes in the United States, which is that this is only possible because the Fox News agenda, the Rupert Murdoch agenda, the Tea Party agenda, this hatred of government, this almost anarchic tendency in what used to be called conservatism has taken hold to such an extent. And that's a huge problem for the rest of the world, right? I think up until this crisis, a lot of the rest of the world was saying, okay, let's just wait this one out. Let's hope that Trump gets defeated in November. And then we can go back to our good relationships with the United States again. I think that's going to be very, very difficult I think you're absolutely right to say that people are buttoning their lips at the moment. They don't know what to say. It's actually genuinely very difficult. But that moment will come because precisely because of the global nature of the pandemic. There will come a time when the pandemic is coming under control, as it's beginning to do in Europe, for example. And people are going to have to say, what happens with travel to the United States, for example? If the United States is still, which tragically, I think it may still be the global epicenter of this crisis, people are going to have to make very hard decisions about the most basic things about how they relate to the United States, because the United States is still going to be a breeding ground for the epidemic. So these questions are going to arise, I think, sooner rather than later. And I think no matter what happens in November, it's going to take a long time, if we ever do, to get back to the notion of the United States as the indispensable nation, as the center of the world. Mm. Maybe it will never.
Yeah, it's a really important question. I just want to reverse slightly, take a slightly different direction, because you brought up November and the election. So, Margaret Sullivan, what does the press do regarding now not Donald Trump necessarily, but Joe Biden, the presumptive nominee for the Democratic Party? There are all these allegations, and your own newspaper, The Washington Post, has said, and let me just quote, Biden himself should address the Tara Reid allegations and release relevant records. That, of course, refers to an allegation of sexual assault made against Biden from the 90s by a former aide. And it turns out that there's a lot of reporting about this. And of course, the Biden campaign flatly denies it. Of course, there are also, and there have been, allegations of very serious nature in this regard against President Trump. So at least when he was candidate Trump. So what do you think is the next step? Because there's a lot of uncomfortable sort of people not quite sure how to deal with this.
Well, from a news perspective, we need to report it out as thoroughly as possible. And that has been happening. It's not the case that that media in the United States has shut this down or not paid attention to it. We absolutely are reporting on it. I mean, maybe not every news organization, but the New York Times, the Washington Post, and others have given it attention and will continue to do so. You know, my paper's editorial board, as you say, called for Biden to come out and address it, and that is something that should happen. And we also have to be careful not to create a false equivalency, the kind of thing that happened in 2016 with Hillary Clinton's email controversy and all of Donald Trump's foibles and misdeeds somehow became equated. So I think we have to be very careful not to elevate this beyond what it either is or isn't. And I don't think we know the answer to that yet. But it's a tricky thing, but we need to learn from the mistakes of the past, absolutely.
Margaret Sullivan, Fintan O'Toole, thank you both very much for joining us tonight. Just as we're all craving human touch and connection in this lockdown world, a new TV series explores a coming-of-age romance for our times. It's called Normal People, and it is the best-selling novel from Irish author Sally Rooney, which now has been adapted for TV by the BBC and Hulu. It's getting rave reviews in the United States and around the world. In this clip, Connell, who's the popular high school jock, he's a student, of course, and Marianne, a student also there, usually the odd one out who marches to her own drumbeat. They take, in this clip, their first tentative steps towards each other. Take a look.
You know, you were saying the other day that you like me. But by the photocopier, you said it.
Yeah.
Yeah, did you mean like as a friend or what?
No. Not just as a friend.
Yeah, I thought that might be implied. I just wasn't sure. See, I'm just a little confused about what I feel. I think it'd be awkward in school if something happened with us.
Mm-hmm.
No one would have to know. Was nice.
All right, what are you laughing for?
Nothing.
Well, you're acting like you've never been kissed before.
I haven't.
And joining me now from London, Daisy Edgar-Jones and Paul Mescal, who play the two main characters, Marianne and Connell. Welcome to the program. You're under lockdown. We're doing all this, you know, via Skype and all sorts of other technology. How do you react to the reaction to this? It's got rave reviews on both sides of the Atlantic. I mean, it seems it's really hitting a spot. Let me ask you first, Marianne.
Yeah, it's quite hard to kind of compute, really, because obviously, you know, it's all kind of just from our phones, you know. So, I mean, it's amazing and it's so wonderful that the show's sort of still able to be viewed and we've still been able to promote it in some capacity because, you know, we didn't know if we could when this all sort of started. But, yeah, it's quite surreal, to be honest.
So, you see, I have totally bought into the story because I called you Marianne. Of course, you're Daisy. And now I'm going to go to Connell. Sorry, Paul. How do you react to this? Did you imagine that this would be, I don't know, that this story would be so evocative of an age that seems bygone? I mean, it's like the Paleozoic era. You're holding hands, you're kissing, you're together. Just comment on the strange time of the release of this.
Yes, I suppose if you had asked me what the reaction would be, I thought it was going to be positive because I was confident in the work that we did. But I think it's very hard to compute or even kind of recognize how positive and effusive the reviews, both kind of critically and publicly, have been. It's just been it's been a bit of a whirlwind of 72 hours, but incredible. And yeah, delighted.
So tell me, what was it about the book? Did you know the book? I mean, you probably had heard of it. It was a massive bestseller, Irish author. What did you think when, you know, about the story? What appealed to you about it, Paul?
I suppose that's the testament to how popular the novel has been, is that I think everybody recognizes themselves in either Connell or Marianne. And I think that's the appeal of the book. And I hope this series, I think what Sally's done so well is that she doesn't kind of make Connell or Marianne heroes or villains. She just does so well to represent them as real, living, breathing human beings, and not kind of, they don't feel fictional to me. And I hope that's the case to audiences of the show and readers of the book.
Yeah, that's a really interesting way to put it. Daisy, You've talked about it as, and we notice that actually these are young people who are not just doing what we understand many young people do, like right now, just meet online or, you know, just endlessly texting and social media. There's a huge amount of connection, verbal connection, and it's very slow and considered and you know, thoughtful between the two characters.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what's so wonderful about their relationship is that they have this very honest way of communicating, and it's quite refreshing to see. I mean, there's a wonderful scene that's one of my favourites in episode 5 where they sort of speak from across the room, and it's really fascinating to see sort of two people just speak very openly and honestly about the way they feel and what they're thinking. But yeah, I mean, I think it weirdly sort of resonates even more at the minute, because I think we're really missing human connection, and it's inherently a story about love and growing up, and it's just lovely seeing two people connect, even if they sometimes miss each other.
Let's talk a little bit about, for want of a better word, what, I don't know, me or others have called sort of a little bit of a power dynamic. And it's not just the class dynamic, because Connell's mother works as a cleaner in Marianne's home, which is a mansion. The two of you are both in the same class at high school. And And Connell, as I said in the introduction, is the popular, he's very studious, he's successful, he's a, you know, he's a sports star. You are also very studious and great at your studies, but you're a bit more of a, I guess, I don't know whether outcast is the right word, but you're not the popular girl, or you don't even want to be. You're very sort of independent. And in that clip we showed, you know, Connell is basically saying, don't let the rest of the school know. And here you are having your first kiss. I just wonder if you can talk to me about that sort of power dynamic that takes the first part of the book and the series.
Yeah, I mean, that's a wonderful sort of question.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I love it. I mean, I think that it's really interesting that Marianne, she at school, sort of, she seems very confident in herself. And I think her school friends find her quite unnerving because she seemingly doesn't care about the social structures, which are so sort of integral to everything when you're at school, you know, where you are on the social ladder, etc. But I think with that, she sort of postures that she doesn't care, but really she is a very vulnerable person. So I think when she has this, you know, relationship with Connell and he says, don't tell anybody, I think Marianne, she understands, she's clever enough to know that to be associated with her isn't a good thing for his sort of social standing. And unfortunately, she doesn't have, I guess, a wonderful view of herself. I think she thinks she's an ultimately cold, unlovable person. And it's very sad, actually. I think she understands where he's coming from.
And it's kind of heartbreaking also, Paul, I want to ask you about the scene where you don't actually invite Marianne to the high school prom. You invite another cool girl in the class and you tell Marianne that, and maybe you don't expect it, but she is heartbroken. And while you're out there in your togs and, you know, dancing with this other girl, she's in bed crying herself to sleep, and you eventually leave the party and probably realize that you've done a pretty awful thing. This is the clip of you leaving that party.
Hey, it's me again. I know it's late to be calling and all that, and I know you probably don't want to talk to me or anything, but I was just calling to say that that I miss you. See, I can't really talk to anybody the way that I talk to you or anything like that. And, I don't really know what to say other than the fact that I miss you, and I really love you, Marianne. And I'm sorry.
It is really, really heartbreaking. Just tell me how you internalize that scene, but also, you know, the what we've just been talking about, the imbalance.
Yeah, I think that's kind of Connell's journey throughout the whole novel, but to focus on that question specifically, I think when Connell goes to tell Marianne that he's inviting Rachel to the Debs, I think in the back of his brain, he's aware of what he's doing and the cause that is going to have on Marianne. And he tries to normalize the situation in the language that he uses with Marianne, and it doesn't go to plan. And I think you start to see the kind of the breadcrumbs throughout that episode when he's like getting ready to go to the Debs, and Lorraine, Connell's mother, kind of says that sometimes you have to do things you don't want to do. And there's a pivotal conversation for him with his friend Eric outside the Debs when Eric says, you know that we know you've been sleeping together the whole time and nobody really cares. And that's the thing that Connell's been protecting the whole way through. And once that kind of carpet's been pulled out from under him, it allows him to really address his behavior internally and in himself. And I think in terms of playing it, it's just about being true to that, like trying to imagine those circumstances. And then when you come to shoot the scene on the phone, you're just telling the person that you've really let down that you're really sorry. And I think that's just, I can imagine that would be a very upsetting phone call to have to, or voicemail to have to leave.
I'm sure many, many people can identify with that. But I do actually want to ask you, because you had an intimacy coach on the set, and this is becoming quite sort of usual now in various films like this. Can you just tell me, from your perspective, Daisy, what that did, how that helped, and is there sort of a post-Me Too aspect to it about consent and boundaries? Just how did that help you?
I mean, it was incredible. I mean, we had Eta O'Brien, who sort of, she worked with sex education, so she'd sort of, she'd worked with young people before the show Sex Education. So she was amazing, because Paul and I, we were both very new to filming those scenes, and they are so integral to the story. It was really important to do them justice. And she just created an environment that was incredibly safe, and there was no pressure involved. And we always knew that we were able to be honest if we weren't comfortable with anything. We were never going to be pushed. And same with Lenny and the director and all the crew. Were sort of created such a lovely environment for us. And yeah, I mean, definitely, I think that I cannot imagine doing those scenes without one. And I really think that that has to be the gold standard, because it's a very vulnerable place to put yourself in, and to know that you have someone who is looking out for you and looking after you and making sure you're safe ultimately makes the work better. And I think, yeah, it's incredibly important that that becomes the norm from now on.
Can I ask you, Paul, how you dealt with that? And I mean, I guess you'd also never come across an intimacy coach. You hadn't had, I don't think, those kinds of scenes in your past. And there's a lot of sex scenes. We're not allowed to show them on this television. But you know, it's all part of the story, and none of it seems gratuitous. And you said, you know, about the key one, it's not clinical, it's loving and romantic and sexy, because you see two minds coming together. Just talk about that, and also about how you reacted to having an intimacy coach on set.
Yeah, I suppose the refreshing thing personally that I find about normal people is that the intimacy is both physically sexual, but the thing that I think really excites both the characters is the way in which their brains work. And I think when you have intimate scenes that require that level of detail, you have to shoot it in a different way. And I think you've got to really invest in the intimacy between Connell and Marianne to really get the payoff at the end of the story. And I think for me, obviously, I totally agree with Daisy. The idea of the intimate scenes is a far more, the idea of doing them was a far more kind of nerve-wracking experience than actually the process. I think we both felt incredibly empowered, and part of the creative discussion throughout all of the sex scenes, and you're right, there is a lot of them, but it's also something that you just get better at as you go along. Me and Daisy obviously got more comfortable with each other, and we knew how those scenes worked. But I think I couldn't, just to reiterate what Daisy said, I couldn't imagine having to do those scenes, nor would I probably sign on to a project where those scenes are required, and an intimacy coordinator wasn't employed. So I think it's been really positive in that sense.
Well, that's really, really interesting. Paul and Daisy, thank you so much. Congratulations on the success. And we haven't even talked about the whole arc of the end. We'll leave that to all the viewers who are going to enjoy seeing the rest of this series. Thank you so much. Now, back to the United States, where states across the country are taking different approaches to the coronavirus pandemic. Our next guest has been looking into this. Charles Duhigg is a contributor for The New Yorker, and he's been comparing the pandemic response in New York and Seattle. Both cities were hit by the outbreak at around the same time, from late February to early March. But today, more than 30% of all U.S. coronavirus deaths are in New York, and less than 2% in Washington State. Duhigg speaks to our Michelle Martin from Brooklyn about it.
Charles Duhigg, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
I have to say that your piece raises a really uncomfortable question, which is, you know, Seattle was so much in the news at the beginning of this outbreak. I mean, we were seeing pictures on the news every day from this one nursing facility right outside of Seattle. But now, these months later, New York is the epicenter of this. There are hundreds of thousands of confirmed COVID cases in New York. There are tens of thousands. I mean, what? How many deaths so far? In the 20,000 range, I believe. And Seattle has and Washington State on the whole, Seattle in particular, has a fraction of that. What happened? What did you find out?
Well, what we found is that Seattle put its public health officials, its scientists, in front of the cameras. And they relied on a
communications playbook that the CDC has polished for over 50 years about how to talk to the public to convince them to stay home. In New York, the politicians took the lead, and the messages that they sent were much more muddied and much more confusing, particularly initially. And the weird thing about a pandemic is that what you do in those first early days can matter disproportionately, because once the virus is out of the gate, it begins expanding exponentially. And that's the mistake that New York made. It was only 4 or 5 days behind Seattle, but those 4 or 5 days made all the difference.
Tell me a little bit more about this playbook, the CDC playbook that you say Seattle followed, that New York didn't.
So the CDC since the 1950s has had a division known as the Epidemic Intelligence Service. And what they do is they take a new class every single year, and for 2 years, they train them how to become essentially the shock troops, the front line in the epidemic response. And oftentimes those people go out as alumni and they become the Commissioner of Health of Los Angeles and Philadelphia and Chicago. And this playbook that they give them, that they train them in, which is actually available online, anyone can go look at it. It's known as the CDC's Field Epidemiology Manual. It tells them exactly how to communicate and has a couple of rules. The first rule is you must maintain trust with the audience, because we know that advice is going to change throughout the course of an epidemic. And whoever the spokesperson is that's speaking to the public, they need to be able to convince people to do things like stay home or avoid going to work, even when that advice might change, even when conditions might change. Another big piece of advice is that it's generally thought to be better for a scientist to be the head of public health messaging than a politician, because as one former CDC director told me, the problem with a politician is that half the nation might just do the opposite of what they're saying because they didn't vote or trust for the guy. And so it's really important to use these principles to maintain this trust, because ultimately a pandemic is as much a communications emergency as it is a health emergency.
Is there one crucial decision you think Seattle made early on that made the difference? I know you said put the scientists first, but is there something you can sort of pinpoint that you say this is the crucial difference here?
Seattle moved very quickly to close its schools and to ask companies to close their workplaces. So literally just days after the first fatality in Seattle, the first fatality in the entire nation, one of the top politicians, a guy named Dow Constantine, called Brad Smith, the president of Microsoft, which is located nearby, and he asked him to tell all of his employees to stay home from work. He did the same thing at Amazon. So as a result, what one Seattle resident told me was he woke up on Tuesday morning and suddenly 100,000 cars were missing from the roads because all the Amazon and Microsoft employees were staying home. And he said, you knew that something important had happened. You knew that something scary was going on because the roads were suddenly empty. And that's kind of the point, is that it's not enough for a leader to simply say something, even if it's a scientific leader. You have to create an atmosphere that convinces people to move fast, because we can order them to stay home, but they don't have to. We're a nation where people do whatever they want. And so what we have to do is we have to persuade them.
Well, what made the officials in Seattle so willing to do that? I mean, I think people who were in the New York area may remember that New York didn't close its schools for at least a couple of weeks after that. And then when did New York close their schools?
New York closed their schools in early March, and there was a long delay in which New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio sort of publicly had this this indecision about whether he ought to close the schools. And he was making a legitimate argument. One of the things he said is, look, if you close the schools, it disproportionately impacts our most vulnerable, right? There's kids who rely on schools for meals. There's health providers who they can't go to work unless their kids are in school because they don't have daycare. Now, at the time, de Blasio was getting recommendations from his own health officers to close the schools and restaurants. In fact, two of de Blasio's top health officers came to him and threatened to resign unless he closed the schools and bars and restaurants. But it is a difficult choice. And one of the things that's interesting, and this is one of the things that the CDC and the Epidemic Intelligence Service teaches, is that almost all the normal rules that apply to a politician suddenly become reversed when you're in a pandemic, right? As a politician, our instinct is always to calm, to avoid panic, to reassure citizens. But in a pandemic, what you actually want to do is you want to foster a little bit of panic because you're trying to convince people to do things that are really hard before they can see the evidence of the disease around them. And panic does a pretty good job of convincing us to choose to change our behavior.
Maybe people outside of New York might not have remembered this, but I know that the mayor, Bill de Blasio, came under some criticism for going to the gym right before he, as just as he was urging other people to stop going to the gym. I mean, you might think, oh, that's kind of petty. Everybody's, you know, everybody wants to do what they want. But why does something like that matter?
It matters enormously because the consistency in messaging is key to persuading people what to do. You know, in a moment of panic, when someone's asking you to do something like stay in your house, what you're saying is like, A, I want to find an excuse to ignore them, and B, I want to understand what's going on. And so if, for instance, as in this case, Governor Andrew Cuomo of New York State says, I'm going to close down all the gyms, and then Mayor Bill de Blasio of New York City asks his driver to take him to a gym that's 9 miles away so he can work out, to the average viewer, they're saying, who am I supposed to listen to? Am I supposed to be like the mayor and go outside, or am I supposed to listen to the governor and stay inside? Anytime you have any conflicting information, particularly in an emergency, when people are scared and they don't know what to listen to, it's really, really dangerous. You can't have these distractions during a pandemic. They become deadly.
What about Governor Cuomo?
Well, initially, Governor Cuomo, similar to Mayor de Blasio, was saying, look, you don't need to be concerned about this. Like, their instinct is to reduce panic, which is usually a pretty good instinct. It's just not the right instinct in a pandemic. And now, I will say, both of them, compared to, say, federal leaders, did get on the horse pretty quickly and start saying, look, this is something to take seriously. We need to be concerned about this. But those 4 or 5 lost days matter a lot. Dr. Tom Frieden, who used to be a commissioner of public health in New York and was the director of the CDC, he actually estimates that if New York had moved about 10 days faster to shut things down, we would have seen 50 to 80% fewer fatalities in New York. And that's
remarkable.
Wait, that's huge.
You're saying that just those couple of days, maybe a week, could have saved thousands of lives?
Absolutely. Because remember, a virus moves in an exponential manner, right? So if you have one case and then 2 cases the next day and then 4 and then 8, it doesn't take that long until you get to 100,000 cases. And then the next day, 200,000 cases. Those initial days matter so much because that's when you can mitigate. That's when you can stop the virus in its tracks. Once it's escaped, once it's spreading to thousands and tens of thousands of people, then you really don't have that many tools to stop the spread except for completely drastic reactions like telling everyone to stay inside.
Let me ask you a hard question, though. Is this a question of sort of the political leadership in Seattle and in Washington State kind of got their act together sooner, were more willing to listen to the scientific authorities, or are just the circumstances of life so different? I mean, the fact is Seattle is a lot less dense, it's a lot less diverse. Washington State is a lot less dense. It's a lot less diverse. There's a lot less international travel. I'm asking you a hard question, but was this a leadership issue or is this a facts on the ground issue in your based on your reporting?
You know, at the end of the day, it's almost impossible to answer that precisely. But let me say this. You're exactly right that New York has some conditions that Seattle doesn't that would have made the spread easier here, but namely population density and the fact that we use public transit so much. But in addition to that, leadership does matter. You know, in Seattle, you had the situation where all of the political leaders were generally aligned. And in addition, these graduates of the Epidemic Intelligence Service, they were in powerful positions. It's a network. They had been working with each other for years. And so when they needed to respond, and they went to the governor, and they went to the mayor and county executive, they could speak with one voice, and those politicians were primed to listen. In New York, although conditions were different, and obviously, there's a chance of luck, an element of luck in every pandemic. In New York, we had the opportunity to respond quickly, but instead what we had was a situation where Bill de Blasio, the mayor of New York, was frankly fighting with his own health department. He was not listening to the advice. There was a history of bad relationships there. And more importantly, there was an ongoing feud between Mayor de Blasio and Governor Andrew Cuomo, the governor of the state of New York. Mm-hmm. And that fight, that feud, has meant that communications have been muddied. They've fought in public about who has the right to close down the schools, what kind of advice should be given out. It's impossible to say if we could rewind the clock that just changing the leadership would have changed the outcome of the course of this pandemic. But certainly in New York, the fact that we are now the epicenter, that we are the epicenter for the entire world and have tens of thousands of deaths, some of that must be laid at the feet of our political leadership. And the fact that, frankly, they weren't ready for this and they weren't listening to the people who were ready and trained about how to communicate during a pandemic.
Were you able to ask each of them why they didn't listen, why they didn't follow the same playbook, at, which you point out is on the internet. You can read it for yourself, which was you know, news to me. Were you able to ask either of them why they didn't follow
Governor
that
Cuomo playbook? And, Governor Cuomo and Bill and Mayor Bill de Blasio both declined to speak with me. Mm-hmm. They did not want to. And look, we're in the middle of an emergency, right? They have a lot of stuff going on. And I will say that in the last few weeks, once it became clear exactly what was happening, both of them did move very actively to start putting in social distancing measures. But they also continue fighting with each other, even just as recently as last week. They were mm-hmm. battling in the press over who has the right to decide to determine when the schools will reopen.
I can't help but notice that Governor Cuomo, as we are speaking, very recently has expressed some regret about the way he has handled his role here. He says that he wished that he had sounded the bugle earlier, meaning, I think, raised alarms about the seriousness of this earlier. What do you make of that?
I think it's great that he is now recognizing that Andrew Cuomo is now recognizing that the cautions should have been made earlier, that they didn't respond fast enough. I obviously don't know what the governor knew, but I do know what people around him and what epidemiologists were saying at the time. Now, perhaps those people weren't shouting loudly enough at Andrew Cuomo. Perhaps they weren't in the room with him, but it's unequivocal that in retrospect, we are going to look back and we are going to say, Andrew Cuomo and Bill de Blasio in New York State, that they didn't act fast enough, that their warnings were out there, that everyone should have known as soon as Seattle started having massive numbers of deaths and massive numbers of cases, that we had to respond immediately and assume that coronavirus was moving through our communities.
You talked about the importance of being consistent. In fact, you used an interesting phrase in your piece about the need for officials to ostentatiously model the behavior that they need people to see. And yet, you know, we see that, you know, President Trump is refusing to wear a mask. He exactly said at a briefing, I'm not going to. And often at the White House briefings, you know, very rarely is anyone wearing a mask. I may have seen one, say, public service announcement by the Surgeon General where the people around him were wearing a mask. But I haven't, as a consistent factor, I haven't seen anybody, including the doctors, wearing masks. I mean, what should we draw from this?
It's a terrible trend, and it's going to kill people. You know, in the 1950s, when the polio vaccine was discovered, there was a huge outcry of people saying that they didn't want to get it, that they actually thought that it was going to give people polio, that it was all a hoax. And so the commissioner, the New York Commissioner of Health, who is actually this woman who was married to the founder of the Epidemic Intelligence Service, she put on a series of public events where people could get shots in public. She would take cameras into schools so that you could see kids getting their shots. She asked Elvis to come and get his shot in front of reporters and in front of TV cameras. And the reason why is because she knew you have to ostentatiously demonstrate this stuff, right? During the H1N1 outbreak, you saw public health officials who were at no risk of being infected. They were inside an office building where nothing was ever going to get. They would wash their hands in public. They would wear masks. When President Trump announces that the guidance has changed and that the CDC is asking us to wear masks in public now at this point for good reason, with scientific basis, and then he says you can do it if you want, I'm not going to do it, I'm not going to wear a mask, at best it's just confusing. And this is a terrible time to have anything confusing going on, because when people get confused, they don't make good choices.
I can imagine that people would be reading this and would be very angry to discover that this is a well-established, as you pointed out, you know, half a century's worth of knowledge about how to handle an epidemic, and that previous leaders have followed it and other jurisdictions have followed it with important results, and they didn't. Do you have an opinion about what should happen as a consequence of this?
Absolutely. I mean, in the near term, what we ought to do is we should listen to that same advice about reopening the economy and reopening societies. There's very clear criteria about when we ought to reopen. We need to have 14 days in a city or a given area of declining case counts of COVID-19. COVID-19 before we reopen that area. Because without that, we know that the virus is expanding rather than contracting. And when we do reopen, we should reopen gradually. And at the first sign that the virus is beginning to tick up, we should reclose, right? It's a process, a series of waves of reopening and then closing down again. We know that from 1918. More people died in San Francisco in 1918 in the fall during the second wave of the influenza epidemic than in the first. And the reason why more people died is because they got tired of wearing their masks. Mm-hmm. So when the city said, you can take your masks off, and then a couple of months later said, put your masks back on, people didn't put them back on. And so thousands more people died. So that's in the near term, that's what we ought to do, is we should just listen to the advice that is out there. We know how to do this. But then the second thing that we should do is we should really think about what this means when we're in the ballot box, right? If anything of the last 8 years, this has shown leadership matters. Who you choose matters a lot in what happens. If you have good leaders, you can escape situations like this. If you have leaders who don't listen to experts, who are not on message, who give in to petty disputes, who give in to their own instincts rather than listening to the better advice of others, you can see the consequences in our graveyards and in our economy.
Charles Duhigg, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And tune in tomorrow. While all major sporting events have been called off, we have an exclusive joint interview with tennis legend Billie Jean King and Wimbledon champ and Olympic champ Andy Murray. We'll talk about how highly trained athletes are coping at home under lockdown. And we'll talk about gender equality on the court as well. And finally tonight, Captain Tom Moore has now raised a staggering £32 million for the NHS by walking 100 laps of his garden here in England on his walking frame. He said he'd do it by his 100th birthday, which is today. So happy birthday, Captain Moore. And to mark the occasion, Captain Moore has been made first honorary colonel. And he's received a Royal Air Force flypast over his house in Bedfordshire. And as we say goodbye, just take a look at the sea of birthday cards that Captain Moore has received from the public. They were opened up by volunteers at his grandson's school. Thank you for watching, and goodbye from London.